I just need you to know I fall asleep to the voice of your husband. And this.
Yeah.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
This stuff has been sitting the better part of a year. It's worthless.
What do you mean?
When it sits for a long time without being turned, that liquid nitro seeps out of the sticks and into the bag. If you give those cases any kind of a bump, it'll blow. It's risky moving one of those cases 10 feet. That fire is over 200 miles away.
Hello, everyone. It is episode 180 of Wreckatopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hi, ho, Shiderinos.
Yeah, the Shiderinos. Also, welcome to the show, Jeremy Scott.
Kaboom!
Yeah. We're going to be talking a lot of kaboom. Last week was bada boom. This week is kaboom.
Big bada boom.
That's right. We'd also like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you guys coming out. Can't wait to talk about the big recommend today, which is Sorcerer. We'll go on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I will kick us off with a movie. Go ahead and fire up your Gesundheit jokes right now. But I watched a movie that I've heard about for a long time, and I never have popped it in. I've got the Criterion collection of this. It's Koyaanisqatsi. Which is basically a sort of visual and sonic feast all the way through the movie. It's basically about it just shows a bunch of like nature at the beginning. Or like, oh wow, this is just like a lot of cool vistas and things like that and amazing stuff to look at and whatever. We have a driving Philip Glass score. I think it's his first ever movie score, as he was asked to do it. And he said something like, I don't do movie scores. But then he said, whoever, I can't remember the guy who directed it. The guy's name escapes me right now. Godfrey Reggio was like, oh, your stuff would work perfectly for this. And it does. You will, if you're familiar with Philip Glass movie scores, you will hear Truman Show throughout this, probably. It shows you all these just sort of natural landmarks. And then all of a sudden, what creeps into the frame are little intrusions like electric wires and towers and things that man has built basically as we go through this. It's almost kind of like watching an evolution of, you know, here's what we had and here's what we're doing to it as it goes along. And yeah, all along while it had you, I don't know, you may get different messages from this thing as you watch it, but there's one moment in particular that I found completely mesmerizing. I think we're all familiar with time-lapse photography and stuff like where, you know, like you see traffic moving and you see all these like these quick lights blasting through this thing. I don't know, something about the way they did it in this and knowing the fact that it's not digital or any sort of like weird special effect or anything like that. Watching traffic for like 5 to 10 minutes, I was just sitting there agape at how like mesmerizing it was watching it and everything. But really, it's just that kind of thing. There are two other movies after this. I guess they kind of touch on, I don't know if they touch on the exact same thing or if it's like, hey, there's even more intrusions now or whatever. But this is something of a, you know, this is something of a must watch. I could see myself, this is going to be sound like a, you know, a negative for this movie, but I could see myself going to sleep to this movie over the next few years, just popping it in and letting it roll. And it just, you know, you just let it, you know, let it run for about an hour and a half. And then, you know, before you know it, you're just lights out and just conked out or whatever. But yeah, no dialogue, no story. It's what you make of it. And yeah, very good. I highly recommend it.
So that Goyaniscotsi.
That's right. Yep. You can't get that out of your head.
No, man. It lives.
So this will replace the previous movie you put in every night when you go to bed, Rosemary's Baby?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it will. It will for sure. I mean, it's hard to knock the king of knocking you out with this, but that's what I'm going to have to do. Rosemary's Baby.
I fired this up on Amazon Prime last night because I knew we'd be talking about it today, and I hadn't seen it before. And about, 10, 15 minutes in, I'm like, Chris, what are we doing? Like, what did you get us into? Because it really is just like you're watching nature, and I'm like, oh, okay. Because, okay, I went in blind, so I had no idea what this was. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, okay, so this is like an experimental, kind of thing. And then it just grows on you. Like, just there's something really interesting about giving yourself to a movie like this and just watching it, not second screening, not messing around on your phone, like just really kind of giving yourself to the emotion of it, which is weird to say because there's not characters or there is a story in that it's about, I think technically the word means life chaotic or life out of balance.
Yeah.
And so it really is about, how technology as it advances us also creates an imbalance in us. And it shows all of these different, things and progresses fairly linear, it's a very linear progression.
Yeah.
So I really liked it overall. It is definitely experimental.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be a top 5 get stoned and watch movie of all time. It's really interesting. So thanks for the recommend, and I jump on and recommend it to others.
You get stoned watching it. I was in a different state watching this movie than, I don't know. There's a feeling that comes over you. I don't know if it's supposed to evoke calm because it's really kind of telling you, like, look at what we're doing to the earth, basically. But at the same time, it's kind of beautiful how they've shot it and edited it and that Philip Glass score and all that. So
I have never seen a Twinkie production line look so beautiful and artistic. And also, I so miss 1980s Twinkies. Like, they're so different now than they were when I was growing up.
That's right. I know
it's because of all the bad stuff that was in them that I really, really enjoy.
Well, and they went bankrupt and a new company bought them. And
Man, but OG Twinkies were the best. Ugh.
Yes. Yes, they were.
Anyways.
All right. What do you got, Aaron?
I'm going back to 1955. I'm, catching up on some stuff. So I saw a movie called Odette. This is a Danish film. The director really didn't do anything critically acclaimed other than this. Carl Dreyer was his name. This was originally a play written by a Danish Lutheran priest, and he brought it to the screen. It is regarded by many as a masterpiece. I think in Sight and Sound 2012, it was in the top 25 of all time. And I see why. I loved this movie. Now, a lot of the reason I love this movie is because of the themes that are dealing with. We're dealing with a religious family here where three brothers, the older brother has given up on his faith. The middle brother believes he is Jesus Christ. And the younger brother is holding on to his faith strongly. And the movie deals with what happens when tragedy hits this family. And it hits it in the oldest son's family. He's married with a child and one on the way. And complications in the delivery of this child create a traumatic situation where this family has to reckon with their faith. They have to determine what they actually believe, what they think is real, what they don't think is real. I was fascinated. It's shot really well, too. It's a gorgeous movie. As well. And a lot of times I've been watching a lot of old, Criterion Channel arty films, whatever. And it's usually French films or, but Danish is a different language. The more Nordic languages are really interesting to me. So to hear them spoken was also kind of interestingly fun. But yeah, it's on Criterion Channel. I'm not sure if it's also on HBO Max. I know there's some crossover there sometimes, but I would recommend Or Dead. It definitely pushed a lot of my buttons.
Have not heard of this movie before, and now I'm very interested in seeing it. What year do you say this was from?
I think it's 55. I think 55 is what IMDb says. I think 57 is what some other places say. So I'm not. Mm. It's somewhere there in the mid 50s.
Yeah. All right. Very interested in that. Jeremy, what you got?
I saw a stand-up special on HBO Max that was released in 2024, and it's Alex Edelman, Just for Us. I really enjoyed it. This is a Jewish comedian, and just for anyone that would be curious, this was filmed in 2023 before the current escalation of the Israel-Palestine conflict. There's no mention of any of that in this special. Mm-hmm. But this is a comic who's a lot more like Birbiglia than a setup punchline comic. This is a storytelling comic. And the central conceit of this, which he claims is 70% a true story, is after a bunch of negative interactions with anti-Semites on Twitter, he ended up going blind to a white nationalist meeting in Brooklyn. It was an online invite that said, do you have questions about your whiteness? And he said, I do have questions about my whiteness. And so the special is him telling the story of being at this white supremacist meeting as a Jewish person, eventually being found out. But he weaves into this story vignettes about his family and his Jewish culture and heritage and his parents. And it's a very, very warm, fond kind of recollection of how he was raised and how unique and different that is from a lot of people. And he sort of compares and contrasts that with the current state of race relations in the world, specifically white nationalists and Jewish people. I laughed a ton, but it also had heart and made me think. And it's an hour and a half on HBO Max, and I recommend it with both thumbs.
Yeah. I do like these storyteller comics. I've not heard of this guy before, but I do like it because there's something about being able to do a stand-up show where you're not so worried about getting a laugh every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
That is kind of brave to me because, you know, you're up there just telling a story and people are like, laugh, monkey, you know, you're make us laugh, monkey, you know, that type of thing. And in this case, you just get wrapped up in the stories that they tell and they have humorous observations about them. So I'll have to give this a look.
This is a great one. He's got a really interesting energy about him as a storyteller too. Like, it's a very high energy, almost like hyperactive delivery style that, you know, could take a couple seconds to get into, but man, the Jewish Christmas story in this special is an all-timer of a story. Like an all-timer of a story. It's incredible. And it's really funny throughout, and this has one of the biggest banger of an endings for a comedy special I've ever seen.
I mean, the ending is perfect.
Yeah,
I really don't think it's true, but
I don't either. I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
It's a killer ending. I'm glad that you've seen it and enjoyed it.
Yeah, good stuff.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, which is Sorcerer, and it was my choice this week, so I will take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Sorcerer is a 1977 film directed by William Friedkin. It is a remake of Henri Georges Clouzot's The Wages of Fear from 1953, based on the book by the same name. The movie starts in Veracruz, where a man in sunglasses named Nilo, played by Francisco Rabal, walks into a hotel room and shoots another man. Before you can get a handle on that, the movie rockets to Jerusalem, where we see three men casually waiting for a bus, leaving a bag behind as they board. As the bus drives away, the building they were sitting next to explodes. They get to their hideout and discuss an exit plan. The short way is dangerous. The long way takes 3 hours. They choose the long way, packing dynamite and other weapons, but it's not long. After that, the Israeli police is hot on their tail. Most of them get shot, one gets arrested, and another named Kasim, played by an actor named Amidou, is left behind. Then we go to Paris, where we see a woman discussing a nonfiction book she's writing with her husband Victor, played by Bruno Crémer, and it looks like they're celebrating their 10th anniversary. Victor leaves, and we see him in a meeting at a stock exchange where he's being accused of fraud. He thinks paying the debt back will keep him out of trouble, saying his father-in-law can take care of it and offering a bribe. But the powers that be say they will continue to press charges unless he comes up with collateral by tomorrow. He goes back to his company to talk to his partner, trying to convince him to talk to his father to bail them out. It's pretty clear this guy's dad isn't going to go for it, and he meets with Victor at a restaurant to tell him so before walking back to his car and committing suicide. Victor tells the maitre d' to tell his wife he needed to attend to some business and leaves the restaurant. Now we go to New Jersey, where we meet Scanlan, played by Rob Schneider, played by Roy Scheider, who seems to be casing a Catholic church where an Italian mob wedding is taking place. Tons of money is being counted in a back room where Scanlan and a bunch of other guys in sunglasses come in to rob it, and they shoot one of the money counters, who just happens to be the mob boss's brother. During the getaway, the robbers start fighting with each other over some stupid shit, and Scanlan, the driver of the car, gets distracted. They crash into a delivery truck and flip over. Scanlan appears to be the only survivor, but the cops show up and Scanlan runs away. He collapses in the middle of the street, where a cop finds him bloodied and with lots of loose money on his person, but I guess he's simply taken to a hospital and left to his own devices after that. The mob boss finds out about Scanlan and orders his death. A buddy tells Scanlan he can get him a passport for the remaining $2,000 he has. After giving him a series of directions where the ultimate destination is unknown, we are taken to a nameless, impoverished, dictator-run Central American country where greedy oil barons have taken over. Kasim is now going by Martinez and is working to construct an oil pipeline, and we see how dangerous the work is when the pipe crashes into one of the workers and he starts bleeding out. We see Victor, now named Serrano, also working for the oil company in a different place. Scanlan, going by Dominguez, has some sort of shit job unloading cargo from planes. And not long after, we see a dirty-ass plane fly into town, and everyone watches it with anticipation. One of the passengers is Nilo, the assassin from the first part of the movie, who tells the customs agent he's in transit. He clearly has some money, definitely more than most who live here. Both Kasim and Victor are looking to get the fuck out of this place, and not long after, we see Scanlan in a bar looking longingly at a Coca-Cola ad with an illustration of a pretty lady on it. But getting the hell out of here costs lots of money. Victor can't even secure a ticket out of here by hawking his 10th anniversary watch. Victor arrives at the bar and strikes up a conversation with Scanlan, who appears to know he used to be a banker of some sort. Anyway, the local cops come in and ask Scanlan questions, asking for an identity card. It's pretty clear the identity card is false, and he's soon arrested for violating immigration laws. He's taken to a jail where apparently they don't want to keep him, but shake him down. Whatever money he makes, he has to give them 33%. Somewhere near an oil derrick, an explosion rocks the place. It appears to be the work of terrorists, but the government is being told it's an accident because terrorists who blow up oil wells in the country are turned into heroes, and the dictator can't be seen chasing after patriots. The oil company, represented by a man named Corlett, played by Ramon Bieri, has only one concern, getting 160,000 barrels distributed by the end of the month, which will be difficult with the just-exploded well on fire. in the next scene, we see trucks delivering the dead to the townspeople, who are in a frenzied rage. Some bodies are charred beyond recognition. It's not long before they start exacting revenge on the men in the truck, quickly getting into fights and dousing the truck with gasoline before setting it on fire. Even the lawmen who come in get physically removed from their horses. The town has fucking had it. Corlette flies out to a remote area where there are some dangerous crates full of dynamite that they will use to stop the raging fire. Every action taken by the man opening the crates is done with an abundance of care. When he gets the slightest amount of nitroglycerin on him, he carefully goes out into the jungle to sling it off, and it causes just a minor explosion, but enough to know that a lot of it is a problem. He considers it worthless because of how old the dynamite is and how much of the liquid has seeped out. It makes it far too dangerous to transport. And the fire is 200 miles away. The desperate Corlette says, "Challenge accepted." After getting bad news about the uselessness of shock mounting the crates on a helicopter because of turbulence, Corlette goes into town to interview potential truck drivers. The company can't open back up for employment until this job gets done, and they dangle exceptional wages for this particular mission. Only four will be hired at a rate of 8,000 pesos. They change it back and forth, the amount on this. 8,000 pesos in 1977 still doesn't sound enough for this, but I don't know. They change the totals. They say $8,000 sometimes. They say $10,000. That changes a little bit. Anyway, not a big deal. It's apparently enough for them to do this. The tryouts are conducted by placing a bottle full of liquid on the dash and seeing how much it jostles around while driving very shitty trucks. The three main characters, plus an older German guy with the fake name Marquez, played by Carl John, are chosen. After a truck maintenance montage, they now need to load the crates using a pulley system where the crates are hooked onto some ropes. This is done wordlessly and carefully, and it sets this movie's tone perfectly. They are positioned into some sand to help prevent some shaking. We find out that two trucks will be carrying three cases each, and considering the firepower, it's easily deduced that they are using two trucks in case one of them blows, which is probable. Victor tries to negotiate. Victor tries to negotiate double the pay and legal residence, but his only answer is, "You leave in 4 hours." Kasim tries to find the old German dude, only to find he's been murdered, quite apparently by the assassin Nilo, who wanted that guy's place for some reason. It seems they have no choice but to let him. Scanlan departs in a truck called Lazaro with Nilo. They get a 15-minute head start so that the redundant truck called Sorcerer can officially go. Victor gives Corlette a letter to send to his wife in case he dies, and he takes off with Kasim. These trucks will now navigate muddy, rocky, hilly terrain. The first obstacle is driving over narrow paths with cliffs where the left tires have to basically drive halfway on the edge, damaging the path as it goes. Then people who have no idea what the danger is become obstacles in the road. A man runs in front of it and then runs to the back, being playful while completely misunderstanding the situation. In the next scene, we see Victor and Kasim at a rickety bridge with tight corners that has obviously been damaged by the previous truck, with a note on a map left behind that says, "Good luck, Serrano." After an argument, Kasim ends up being the driver while Victor gives directions from the outside. Things go swimmingly for a bit until one of the tires crashes through a weak board. The crates don't blow up, but now they have to get this truck unstuck. Victor beckons Kasim forward, which he does not want to do, but realizes there's no other choice. After some struggle, the front tire finally gets level with the bridge. Despite some more damage at the end of it, the truck makes it through. Onto the jungle terrain, where a downpour is underway. They come to a crossroads where Dennis Nedry broke the sign in Jurassic Park. So they have no idea where to go. They ask a wanderer inside the jungle where Poza Rica is, but they don't get any real answer other than Poza Rica is dead. Victor and Kasim catch up and tell Scanlan that they're going down the wrong road. Scanlan thinks that the road they're on will be better because the so-called correct road goes through a swamp. Victor argues that they have no idea where that other road leads. When Scanlan suggests, "You go your way and we'll go ours," Victor sternly says, "We follow the map." They go down the road and find a bridge going over a raging river that is completely unsuitable for what they need to do. It's beyond repair, with holes through the center and many places. It doesn't look like it could carry their weight, and it's held up by very loose ropes that cause the bridge to sway. Nilo tries to run, but Scanlan tackles him and tells him that they're going across, with Nilo guiding him because it can't be done alone. So begins a slow drive over this bridge in a downpour, with Nilo inspecting each step of the way to help navigate. At one point, the truck gets to a spot where it starts swaying ever so slightly. After a tense drive, they make it to the other side, and Scanlan tells Nilo he doesn't think the other team has a chance of making it, thinking they'll get twice their share when this is all over. The other team takes the same tactic, though, with Victor driving and Kasim doing the navigating. At some point, Kasim steps on a board that falls completely through and is barely able to hold on. But Victor doesn't seem to see Kasim and keeps going. Just as he's about to run him over, Victor stops. Disaster averted, except now it seems the river has brought a huge pile of broken branches into the bridge, trapping them. And this, by the way, if you're watching the movie called Sorcerer, seems like a sorcerer type of scene. Like, that's like a true horror movie moment when these branches show up on the bridge and like enclose them and everything. Victor pulls out a machete to cut down the branches while Kasim retrieves the winch to wrap around a stump just past the end of the bridge. The truck, now digging hard into the boards of the bridge, makes an even more treacherous drive. The truck's windshield becomes nearly opaque. The tires start losing traction as the ropes of the bridge start to get frayed and are about to snap. Just as the rope breaks, the truck makes its final lunge to the other side, but before we see if they make it or not, the movie cuts away to show us Scanlan and Nilo, who have run into a real obstacle, a giant tree that has fallen down and is completely blocking the path. Scanlan thinks they can chop down 8 trees using machetes and go around the felled tree, to which Nilo replies by pulling out a gun and shooting it just past Scanlan. Scanlan tries to pitch this idea to Victor and Kasim when they arrive, but is rightfully asked, how would you clear out the trees? How would you get past the stumps? Doesn't matter. Scanlan starts aimlessly hacking everything in sight. Eventually, he realizes the madness. But then, a miracle, Kasim thinks he can clear the tree out somehow. So what happens? Kasim cuts a hole in the tree, and the others carve 3 large branches that will all be stacked around the tree to form a support. In the next scene, they're looking for rocks, one large one to fill the hole in the tree, and a smaller one to be tied to a string held up by the support, which will suspend it over the bigger one. They then need to find a big enough container that can hold enough sand to attach the smaller rock as a counterweight and to wedge into a support. Kasim cuts out one of Nilo's pockets for that, hanging it on another support that's stuck in the ground. Now it's time to take out one of the crates full of dynamite. After carefully removing the plastic wrap full of nitro from the crate, they place it on top of the huge rock. The others run away and drive the trucks to a safe distance. Kasim fashions a tiny stick to poke into the bag of nitro so that it will leak onto the rock. He then pokes a hole into the counterweight, allowing the sand to start falling out slowly and giving him a chance to get the fuck out of there. But he's also injured and running over uneven ground, so there's a lot of suspense as to whether he'll make it. Finally, the sand sifts out enough to cause it to let go of the small rock, which smashes into the bigger rock with the nitro and blows that tree to smithereens. Now, on the final leg of the trip, they are clear of the jungle and driving down narrow roads with cliffs on both sides. Things seem to have calmed down enough that Victor and Kasim are exchanging pleasantries. Just as Victor shows Kasim his anniversary watch, the sorcerer's front left tire blows, causing the truck to redirect towards the cliff and fall, causing the nitro to dislodge and slam into the back of the front seats. The truck explodes. Eventually, Scanlan and Nilo comes across the wreckage. The trouble isn't over. They are confronted by bandits. Nilo refuses to leave the truck, but they don't want to shoot him in the truck because they want to steal that too, and they think it has supplies they can use. When one of the bandits yells something after looking in the back of the truck, Nilo uses this distraction to shoot and kill all the bandits in front of him. Nilo gets shot himself. While the leader goes to help, Scanlan swings an axe into his neck. Scanlan helps Nilo back into the truck and they move on. And while Nilo imagines using the money to buy hookers, it's pretty clear he's not long for this world. Scanlan continues to drive while flashing back to how he got here. Eventually, Scanlan removes the dying Nilo from the truck, and then he gets back in, only to find the truck broken down. The odometer says he's got a little over a mile to go. He starts making that relatively short but oh-so-long walk with one of the crates. Extremely tired and dazed, he shows up to the burning well and is immediately surrounded by oil company workers who take the nitro from him before he collapses from exhaustion. Scanlan gets helicoptered back to the town. At a bar, Corlette gives Scanlan a check for $40,000 and a passport. Corlette also gives him Victor's letter to his wife so he can mail it. He goes over to the woman that apparently Victor was banging and has a dance with her for the apparent somewhat happy ending. But a taxi shows up with the mob boss, Carlo Ricci, and the buddy who helped him leave the country. As they walk into the bar, the movie ends. Guys, what did you think of Sorcerer?
I didn't really care. I'm just kidding. This movie rules. I love the ending. The ending, to me, is something more movies should emulate. Not just the, is it a happy ending? It's not. But the way they sort of leave it up to you to figure out what happens from there, even though you could argue it's pretty obvious what's going to happen. But after everything this dude has been through, the movie is still not going to let him. And granted, these are all evil people. Like, it's a miracle that we're pulling for them at any point along the way.
Right?
Because they're all terrible, terrible people. And it's
added on top of that, they're working for an arguably evil company.
Yes. Yeah. It's the magic of the movie that makes you root for them in spite of all of that. And I think Roy Scheider probably gets some credit too for being the kind of magnetic actor that can draw you in. Between your small recommend, which I'm definitely going to watch now, and this, just bring me more movies with less dialogue. Mm-hmm. Bring me more movies that, like, was trying to use as little dialogue as possible in this movie. Mm-hmm. And you can tell. I bet the script was only like 50 pages. And it's a masterclass in show don't tell and how the visuals can create the tension. You'd mentioned that pulley scene where they're moving the nitro into the trucks. Mm-hmm. And that is tense as fuck. But I also love the contraptions. I saw the chat talking about this a little bit, but there's so much cool engineering stuff in this movie.
Yeah.
The truck building montage is outstanding, where they have to pull pieces from dozens of different trucks and put them together to make two workable trucks. The pulley thing they create, that tree explosion, sand dropping, nitro rock thing. It's like watching, somebody said MacGyver in the chat, it's like watching, you know, Mr. Science or something while you're being thrilled by a really tense movie. There's one question I have, and maybe you guys can answer it, but somehow Serrano's truck gets in front of Jackie's truck at the downed log so that when they go to drive off again, Serrano's truck is in front. And I don't know how that could have happened. I rewound it a little bit to try and figure out. I think that might have cut a scene or something.
My only guess on this is after they backed the trucks away from the bomb that was about to go off, that that truck got ahead of the other truck. But you're right. They don't really have any explanation. It was always the Lazarus truck that was ahead during the whole thing. And then somehow the Sorcerer truck ends up ahead for whatever reason. We aren't told. Maybe it doesn't matter at this point. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have an official answer on that one. No.
I like that the movie is just harsh everywhere, right? These are all evil people. Mm-hmm. If they're working for an evil company. Shit, the marriage happening in the church where the mobster is shot, the bride has a black eye. Like, they zoom in to make sure you know this bride has been abused by her about-to-be husband. Like, everyone is getting shit in this movie. I only took, like, 12 notes because the movie was so engrossing. I wrote one cinema sin about how he asks for extra machetes before they leave. Because there's so much mud, we're going to chop down half the jungle to cover up the mud. And they never use machetes to chop down the jungle to cover up the mud in the whole journey. They never do that. They use the machetes, but not for that purpose. And I was disappointed because I felt like That was Chekhov's chop down the brush to cover up the mud, and then they didn't fulfill it. Yeah, I mean, that's basically, I loved it. I loved it so much. I want to watch the original because I know you guys have both said that that's just as good in its own way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like I can see how this movie inspired directors that, you know, I was watching movies of in the 80s and 90s and whatnot. Yeah, it was really, really, just, really impressive.
If you guys do end up watching The Wages of Fear, there are a lot of differences, obviously. It's basically the same movie, same problem that they're going through or whatever, but they're the challenges are slightly different. And then, I know that a lot of people probably started watching this movie thinking, did I start the right movie? Because
I did.
It takes a forever for them to get to the actual trucks part of this, the thing that the movie's known for. And Wages of Fear is no different. You'll be like wondering what the hell this movie's about because it really gets into the nitty gritty of the small town and the economic issues going on and everything. If you want to, these movies complement each other in a pretty good way because like Wages of Fear really kind of goes over the life that these people are forced into when they're at this thing. Here it's kind of like, well, we're hiding out and we'll just take what we can get and whatever, and it doesn't really focus on the townspeople that much, but like in Wages of Fear you really get a focus on all the townspeople and everything. Anyway, what do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, I love this movie as well. Loved it even more this time through. I, you know, was first going to talk about the setup to this movie, which is almost half the movie. Like it's, you know, it's 45 minutes before we're in the trucks. And, you know, you mentioned that more movies need to have that kind of ending, with, you know, a little more ambiguous. I also think we have come to a place where the efficiency of storytelling has creeped in a little on the importance of character development and the importance of setting up themes and those kind of things. And if you do it well, 45 minutes isn't going to feel like 45 minutes. It's just going to feel like you're setting up these characters in their own vignettes. And, you know, and I think movies could modern movies could take a cue from this as well and give us a little more, rounding out of the characters at the beginning. I think this movie succeeds in many ways, but for me mostly succeeds thematically as a movie about desperation, in the idea of how, you know, you can throw poverty in there, you can throw, you know, systematic inequality in there, whatever, which I think are, like you said, even bigger parts of the original Wages of Fear. You throw that stuff in desperation. According to this movie, and I think I find a lot of truth here, you know, does not lead to positive outcomes. Desperation leads to negative outcomes. It leads to terrible choices, unethical choices, immoral choices, evil choices. And
yeah,
and how people get to desperation is certainly something worth exploring. But this movie is more interested in exploring what happens when people are at desperation. And that goes from the opening vignettes all the way through the end of the movie. I think it's really well done. This is a how did they do that Hall of Fame movie. You watch three or four of these set pieces and just go, how? And then you go to the trivia and you're like, okay, this is how, and you're still going, no, but how? Like, even after you read what they did, you're like, how did nobody die? How did you pull this off? There's the whole thing about the crossing of the bridge was actually a second location because they had set the entire bridge up at the first location and the river dried up. So they had to find another river, and that river almost dried up as well. It was very shallow. So then they had to create like the storm using helicopters and water hoses and like all of these things. While keeping it guarded because the locals thought they were bringing the drought by doing this. And so they were threatening to blow up the stuff they were setting up. It's wild to read about the stuff that they had to do, you know, clearing the log. They actually had to hire like a code named explosive expert, you know, that was like shady because their explosive experts couldn't figure out how to blow up that tree. So yeah, there's just a lot of stuff like that. And then the movie understands, you know, humor every once in a while too. You know, the training scene is very funny.
Yeah.
And watching the guy pull the knob off of the, you know, the clutch, the shifter, and not understanding how that, by the way, that would be me. I would be so at a loss trying to shift and do all that stuff. And then you add to that, you know, Rob Schneider being in the truck, being like, "You can't do it."
Exactly.
Lots of humor there.
Yeah,
man, I thought of that joke, that very joke, when he said Rob Schneider on accident earlier.
Of course.
I thought later in the show, I'm going to say, "You can do it," and then I forgot, and Aaron stole my thought.
I picked it up.
Yeah, you were thinking, you're talking about, you know, the how they did it and everything. The bridge apparently was as filmed, you know, you're like, how did they do it in the, you know, how are they doing it in the world of the movie? Well, that's how they did it in the real world, apparently. They the challenges that were presented to them were the exact same challenges that were in the movie. They had, of course, they had some things that tried to help with the safety of it all, but it still was a dangerous as fuck thing to do. And so, you know, you read through the trivia and most of this is like, oh my God, I hate William Friedkin so much. And, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, one of the things too, he got off to a bad start because he wanted Steve McQueen, apparently, to play this this role, and Steve McQueen only would agree to it as long as Ally McGraw, his wife at the time, got a part in it. And there's not very many female parts in this movie, so like, I don't know what Steve McQueen was hoping. Maybe he was hoping she'd be Victor's wife or something. I don't know. I guess that's a possibility, but I thought that was funny. But like, yeah, it's amazing going back to the 70s and seeing how these directors got all this power and they were allowed to do anything they wanted. And those were usually the movies that set them on a bad path afterwards. Like William Friedkin coming off of French Connection and The Exorcist probably couldn't have gotten a bigger blank check to do this movie, even though it's going across the world and he's spending $1 million each time to try to get this bridge thing to work and all that other stuff. They're just letting him do it because, hey, he got us two movies. We'll just go ahead and let him do this stuff. It's the same thing with Coppola when he did his movies and he went and did that Apocalypse Now for like 2 or 3 years, basically. It was Michael Camino after he did Deer Hunter and trying to do the Heaven's Gate afterwards. I mean, it's so many times this you see this story over and over and over again in the 70s, how these guys basically just couldn't be told no after a success or two. So not surprising here that, you know, that Sorcerer was this movie for Friedkin. The name of the movie is weird, obviously. I mean, you barely, if you're looking carefully, you can see that the truck is named Sorcerer, but why is the whole movie called Sorcerer? We don't know. And Friedkin says something like, it's that evil that draws you into the blah blah blah, whatever. It's a very weird and probably not true you know, reason for the title. It's just something that after the fact, you know, I feel like people saw The Exorcist and they saw something made by the same director called Sorcerer. That's exactly what they were expecting, and maybe that was a marketing thing at the beginning, and they were like, let's draw these people in. But I don't know what they expected after the beginning of the movie. Like, the very first shot of the movie makes you think it's going to be a horror movie. But then what then after that? Right? You know, I mean, you're going to get a bunch of people just walking out and demanding refunds because it's not a horror movie or whatever. But yeah, it is funny watching reading the trivia on this, because William Friedkin did not make himself popular whatsoever.
Imagine, I mean, the IMDb even says that when this went to theatrical, Paramount insisted every showing open with a 3.5 minute overture, musical overture, that they wouldn't let anyone edit. That's a weird thing in and of itself. But imagine going to see this movie. You bought a ticket for Sorcerer. Mm-hmm. The movie starts and there's no picture. You hear 3.5 minutes of overture, and then you get the opening 4 vignettes of this movie. Mm. By like 20 minutes in, you got to be like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. What the hell is this?
Yeah, exactly.
I think the original The problem with this title is, you know, as you've mentioned, varied, but it's also hard when the original has the perfect title. Like, Wages of Fear is the perfect title for this. Like, yeah, you know, sure. So it was going to be a come down of some sort. But yeah, Sorcerer is a little weird titling for sure.
This is also, we've mentioned this before, this is also one of those all-time, what would have happened, I don't know if it would have been a hit or not, but the movie came out, I believe, in June of 1977. And Star Wars had not quite become a wide release yet. It's weird thinking about movies being released this way back then, like big, huge movies like Star Wars were given limited releases back in the day, and then they'd expand. I think they were still doing this even in the 80s. Like E.T. has a limited release, and then it goes wide later. But, you know, the people coming to see this movie in June, like it didn't do that much. And I think there's like a story about Grauman's Chinese Theater or whatever, talking about like how, like, you know, they played this and they just made no money. And they was like, let's get Star Wars back in here. My God, we need to get Star Wars back in here. So Sorcerer really came out at the exact wrong time. It makes me wonder what would have happened if it had come out before, or if it even, like, I don't know at what point. I was barely alive when all of this was going on. At what point could you have come out with this movie? Because Star Wars would have been a phenomenon all the way through the year. In fact, it would have gone into the next year. So is there a chance for this movie at all once Star Wars comes out? That's a big question. But at the same time, you can clearly point to it and say it certainly didn't help this movie's fortunes that Star Wars was out at this time.
It was funny. I was telling somebody who was watching with me, you know, the story of what happened off the top of my head. And I said it was Jaws that had overtaken, you know, Sorcerer or whatever. And then I'm sitting there thinking, wait, that's also Roy Scheider in Jaws. Did he really have two movies out of it? So then I looked at it. Oh, no, it was Star Wars. That's what it was. Star Wars that was the behemoth.
And getting back to Steve McQueen too, like, I think Friedkin wanted, after he couldn't get McQueen, he tried to get like Jack Nicholson and somebody else big for this, and by the end of it, like, of course he couldn't get those guys, they didn't want to travel, and I don't know if they would have been able to put up with all the stuff that was going on the set, but so Roy Scheider's coming in as his like fifth, sixth, maybe even way past that choice. And like, they didn't get along at all. They had worked together on The French Connection. And I think Friedkin said something like, oh, he was a different person then. And then I think Jaws made him impossible to work with. But who knows? It sounds like Friedkin was kind of impossible to work with.
Yeah, well,
Somehow, some way makes a really good movie out of all this nonsense. So yeah. Who am I to say?
Well, Hollywood's history is littered with assholes that make amazing movies. So maybe he's just another along the line.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think history is full of jerks that do amazing things outside of even the cinema industry. Like, you know,
you're right.
Yeah.
Humanity has its way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get on to our super secret double feature.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I haven't gone first in ages because it usually results in me stealing someone's thunder. So let's hope that doesn't happen. I have a list of 10 movies here.
Oh.
Let's be honest. This is not an easy movie for me to double feature. It's so singular in what it is and what it's trying to be. I'm not going to find an easy, oh, this is like that. But I was so impressed by the engineering two or three different times in this movie, the cleverness in building a contraption. And then you add in strangers who maybe don't like each other, having to work together to survive a situation. And I went with Flight of the Phoenix. And you could choose either one, but I'm most familiar with the one that has Dennis Quaid and Giovanni Ribisi in it. I had a lot of other thoughts. I'm not going to say any until Aaron is gone. But
do you,
I didn't.
By the way, just as an aside, do you like that Flight of the Phoenix?
It's okay. I've seen the Dennis Quaid one twice.
I've never seen the original. I've seen the remake. I don't remember liking the remake all that much, but I feel like I would appreciate it now more if I watched it now. But
the original's better. Yeah, I figured I didn't want to put you through another 2 hours of tension. Like, this Flight of the Phoenix is not tense from moment one all the way through.
Right.
I do think there are enough parallels there. So that's what I went with. Aaron?
All right.
Very nice. That's on my list of shame. I really need to see probably both of those. Are there three Flight of the Phoenixes? There's one in 84 as well.
Might have been a TV movie.
Yeah, could have been. I kind of went on vibes with this one a little bit. I think there's something so great about watching a movie that has you on the edge of your seat, holds your attention. You just wonder if the goal's going to be accomplished. Will they get through this? And I have never felt that more than the border crossing scene in Sicario. And I think there's some really interesting parallels to these two movies dealing with the themes of desperation and, you know, what you do to survive and you know, those kind of characters. And then again, the tension of will they accomplish this goal? Will they do what they're trying to do? Also it's one word S word, a lot of the same letters, you know, you could miss Sorcerer, Sicario, they look the same. That makes a great double feature.
Right.
So, you know, that's the most important.
Not the same amount of letters though.
I sat on Jaws for a good while.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because of Roy Scheider. I just thought these two movies feel similar to me in the journey.
Yeah.
People coming together to face a crisis. And I also thought about Munich for a good while.
Yeah.
For similar reasons, strangers coming together to accomplish this dangerous, huge task.
Yeah.
I think doing double features is probably my favorite part of doing these episodes. It's so fun.
All right. Next week's homework. It'll be Jeremy's turn. So, Jeremy, what do we got for us next week?
All right. Next week, we're going with a movie I have Small recommended before on this show. And it is a vibes movie. It is a comfort food movie for me. It is a great soundtrack movie. And it's Ben Stiller's Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is on Hulu and Disney Plus, Hulu Plus Disney. and I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times, showed it to my wife earlier this year. I think that's when I ended up small recommending it on this show. And I can't wait to discuss with you guys. It's certainly a change of pace from Sorcerer in terms of tone and content. there you go, guys.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it. I remember really, really liking this. I don't think I saw this in theaters, and it had mixed to negative reviews when it came out.
Yep.
And so I was like, I don't know. Wait, I guess I'll wait for video or whatever. I watched it and I was like, man, I really like this movie. I thought it was really good. So I'm looking forward to revisiting it. It has been a while since I've seen it. So I think when it first came out on video was when I first saw it. So, I mean, I'll look forward to see this. I always like Ben Stiller's stuff. So
I have a sneaking suspicion this one's going to jump in my estimation. I had pretty mixed feelings about it the first time I saw it. I remember really liking some of it, some of the scenes, some of the things it's dealing with, and then feeling that it was a little bit disjointed, that it was a little bit you know, could have been tightened up, but I have a sneaking suspicion I'm going to fall in love with this movie this time through, because it is definitely my kind of movie. So Yeah.
And yeah, surprise Sean Penn in this movie. You know, one of those type of things that just
he looms large over the whole thing.
yeah, exactly.
So this is a 52 on Rotten Tomatoes, but a 7.3 on IMDb.
Yeah, I think it's one of those movies that people have sort of discovered over the years. Like, if you watched if you looked at the IMDb when this movie first came out, you probably saw like a 6.2 or a 6.3. Yeah. But now that you look at it, it's great. You know, like a full point has gone up at this point. All right, looks like we have time for one question.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Let's see. Funnily enough, movies you currently or used to I did not. Movies you currently or used to fall asleep to. What do you got?
Man, when I was in middle school, I watched two movies ceaselessly. Candle Shoe with Jodie Foster and The Muppets Take Manhattan. And I used to fall asleep to The Muppets Take Manhattan when it was my turn to choose. My brother and I shared a bedroom. And when it was his turn to choose, we usually fell asleep to The Beach Boys' Greatest Hits. So there you go. Muppets Take Manhattan was mine.
No, nice.
I think I simply wrote does not compute. I don't know if I've ever fallen asleep to a movie in that kind of way. Certainly I've fallen asleep at the theater if I'm bored or whatever, like that has happened, but not often. But I certainly haven't put on a TV show or a movie while I'm going to sleep. I always turn the lights out and turn out all the sounds and go to sleep. I don't know. I guess people do that, but it's just not something I've ever done. So.
You'd be surprised how many people have something on or a noisemaker. Like, it's just too quiet for me personally.
Right.
But also, I have tinnitus, so quiet just makes it louder for that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
And then there are, you know, we've got countless people tell us that they turn on CinemaSins videos and fall asleep while those are playing. I mean, I don't know how widespread it is. I totally get what you're saying, that everybody doesn't do this.
Right.
And if you haven't, it probably seems really foreign. For me, I like to have a little something audibly in the background.
Yeah, that
there's something about go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, that reminds me of one of my favorite stories. There was a young woman from our church, and we were eating lunch with her, my wife and I, and she found out that I did the voice of TV Sins, and she was like, no, that's not you. And I was like, it's me. And I pulled it up, and she's like, oh my goodness. And she looked at my wife and she said, I just need you to know I fall asleep to the voice of your husband. And this.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go.
It's a thing. I don't do this very often either, but there's something about when, you know, you watch something that you know very well, you don't have to keep up with it and all of that. Mm-hmm. You just let it roll.
Sure.
And then you don't have to do anything. Like, for me, man, it's great to just conk out instead of like, I am going to bed and I am going to sleep now. That's usually not how it works for me. I have to start watching things and then just, and as I'm drooping, I'll usually turn off the TV or whatever. Yeah. But the idea of watching something that you're familiar with and if I fall asleep during this, who cares? It's, you know, I know this movie.
Yeah.
But I did do this. I recently did this with Ex Machina. It's a movie that really kind of puts you in kind of this sort of, I don't know, it's almost a dreamlike mood. It's a distant place. It's a very quiet movie for the most part and everything. But I've done it with loud movies too. I mean, I've done it with Total Recall. I've done it with The Terminator. Movies that I know, you know, Total Recall is a good one, by the way. That's dreamlike state. Mm-hmm. The movies that it's always been that type of thing where it's like, okay, I've seen this movie 50 times. I'll, you know, if I conk out, I don't have to worry about turning the TV off. I don't have to worry about like anything else. If I conk out, I conk out and it's great. And that's sort of how that goes down a lot of times. I totally understand though the does not compute thing, because that's me generally. I don't like to fall asleep to movies at all and whatever, but there you go. Over in the chat, looks like we have, what do we have? No one says A New Hope or The Phantom Menace for me. Mm-hmm. I would have a very hard time putting The Phantom Menace in for any reason at this point. But, you know, to each his own. You know, A New Hope would be a good one. Let's see. Miss Ree says, usually that Harry Potter or Marvel compilation videos. Oh, for CinemaSins. This is talking about the CinemaSins videos that you were just mentioning people go fall asleep to. Let's see. Lang says Street Fighter Legend of Chun-Li.
Awesome.
Most of you have your different ways of falling asleep. ASMR, brown noise, things like that I saw mentioned in this chat as well. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Next week is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Can't wait to get into that movie again. But that's going to do it for this week, guys. Thank you, chat, so much. Appreciate you for coming out and watching us today. That's all for today. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Here's a little dance for you. Goodbye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
What Redford movie should I watch today in honor of his passing?
So many. Anytime there's a celebrity death, I get three different sources sending me either texts or Slacks or whatever. And it's just like a whole bunch of discussion between all these people. But God, that's a tough one.
We're talking Redford. Which Redford movie to watch today?
I would say The Sting is the start.
I would go straight to Sneakers, but as I've already learned this morning, no streaming services have Sneakers at all.
Oh no.
Oh, that's weird.
But yeah,
I would think that Peacock would have it since it's a Universal movie.
Man, there's plenty I haven't watched. Here's some.
What
of
if you
ones.
Haven't? Yeah.
Here's some of the big ones I haven't seen. The Way We Were.
Okay. I haven't seen that either.
Spy Game.
Spy Game's okay.
It's okay.
The Discovery, 2017.
Don't know that one.
Bridge Too Far, 1977.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen that movie in forever, and so I'll probably be talking out of my ass. I don't remember that being a Redford movie, quote unquote. Okay. There's so many people in it.
This is probably the answer. Jeremiah Johnson, 1972.
Yeah, that's what gives you that meme that everybody thinks is Zach Galifianakis.
Zach Galifianakis, yeah. Yeah. Wait, that's Robert Redford? What? Yeah, that's probably the answer. Well, Barefoot in the Park, I also haven't seen. That's 67.
I've seen that one, but I don't remember it being like super
close and
good.
Personal.
Oh yeah,
Pfeiffer.
That was like Celine Dion had that huge Titanic song, and then she had a huge song for Up Close and Personal, I think, the following year.
Oh, I don't remember that. That's funny.
It's that Because You Loved Me song. Because you love me.
Yeah, Chris, I can knock off a movie for Robert Redford and you at the same time.
Yeah.
I have not seen The Last Castle, so.
Oh,
you bastard.
I did make that joke earlier today where I was talking with some movie friends about it, and I was like, well, I also co-starred with Robert Redford in The Last Castle.
I saw him
up close and personal.
There you go.
And if he had wanted, he could have seen you up close and personal.
Yes, it's exactly the same. It's true. Yes, I mean, Jeremy saw it before I did. Jeremy saw that I was in the movie before I did. I remember him telling me about it because I didn't get to see that. You were at Hollywood 27 when the movie came out, and I wasn't at any theater. And you had the preview on the Thursday night or whatever, and I'm sure Josh and Jeremy and all them were in that screening, but I didn't go. I didn't go probably because I had at the time I had three different jobs. I was extra on The Last Castle, although that was over by that point, but I also had that newspaper delivering thing that would take up my entire midnight to 4 o'clock or whatever. And then, I would sometimes work at a comic book store, but I remember Jeremy emailing me and saying, yep, you're totally in it. And, I have a scene. I share screen space with Robert Redford in The Last Castle.
Do you know, timestamp on that or like relative?
I could get it to you. Cause I have the movie ripped. I can go to that spot, but it's about midway because that's the scene where he's carrying rocks back and forth on the wall. Yeah. They give him that punishment, and Redford talks to one of the guys, and while they're talking, it's like a lunch bell or something. I'm walking behind him in one scene, and they even got the continuity right, and they cut, and I'm still behind him.
Nice.
As the scene ends, so...
Very cool.
I like that movie, but I don't think I could be objective about it. Like, because you had your experience and you're in it, and I know Jeremy and he's in it and he has lines. I just think I'm too close to it to watch it objectively.
Speaking of being objective, I know we're running out of time, but I did want to ask you, Jeremy, your thoughts on the Emmys and Nate Bargatze hosting the Emmys.
I didn't end up watching very much of it. And I'm going to be honest. When I tuned in when it started, and he was doing that for the third time, doing that skit he did on SNL with just different jokes. And listen, Nate Bargatze is probably my favorite comic right now. I'm not trying to rag on him. But from an entertainment perspective, for me, I flipped the channel right away. I've already seen that skit twice. And then I kind of got into something else and flipped back a few times to watch. So I didn't really watch it that much. But the clips that I've seen, it seems like he handled himself really well. I have read some criticism of the whole charitable donations bit. Even though I don't think I have a problem with it. Some people apparently thought it was unfunny or he went back to that well too many times for jokes. Did you watch the ceremony?
I watched the whole thing. There are enough shows that I love that were up for awards that, I was kind of interested. I was surprised I watched the whole thing. I wasn't planning to, but I was like, oh, how is The Pitt going to do? It's one of the greatest
Very
shows
well,
ever.
Apparently.
I'm going to be honest. I think he was terrible. It's one of the worst hosting jobs I've ever seen.
Really?
I love Nate. I love his comedy. I think he's great. I think he was so far out of his element and just thought he could kind of show up and be himself. And that was going to be enough. Like, there's nothing... I shouldn't say nothing. There are very few interesting things that he said or did. It was just every break he would go, oh, let's take a look at the counter. How's the counter? Like, I mean, every single time it was the same joke. So going back to the well, that is definitely it. And I just don't think his style of persona works for that environment.
You need
at
somebody
all.
With a little more edge, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he is not ingratiated to that community in any way, too, so they don't have any benefit of, enjoying him or whatever. So,
but they got, one of the highest-rated audiences. Like,
well, because he's got such a huge audience. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah,
I wouldn't
terrible.
Be surprised if they bring him back, even if all of Hollywood didn't enjoy him, if they get the ratings they want.
I know we're about to go to our bump here, but the timestamp for The Last Castle is 41:33.
Oh, nice, 41:33.
Might be a little bit, might be a little bit before that, but
did that very quickly.
But that's where I paused it. So,
listen up, football fans! You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.